I'm Caleb Brown, host of the Cato Daily Podcast, and I'm taking this time to ask you during the month of December to financially support the Cato Daily Podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute to advance liberty, limited government, free markets, and peace. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and support us this holiday season. This is the only time of the year when I make this request, so I'm adding something. If you support Cato to the tune of $1,000 or more, I'll give you a shout-out on the podcast, or you can designate someone else to receive all the benefits of that donation. Just visit cato.org/podcast sponsor to get started, and thank you. This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, December 17th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. The murder of U.S. journalist Jamal Khashoggi may well have been the last straw as the U.S. Senate moved to begin the process of withdrawing assistance for the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The Cato Institute's SpyCon last week, I spoke with journalist Spencer Ackerman about the role of journalists in these fraught times and how risky good journalism can sometimes be. The ability of governments to surveil and the ability of individuals to encrypt communications are both greater than ever. So how has this technology really changed how people do what we could term sensitive journalism?
It's given people, particularly those who might be willing to talk to reporters without authorization, a greater understanding of what their vulnerabilities might be and an understanding of either some workarounds or some options available to limit their exposure. Without talking about any specific measures, it's been really interesting to see how in the years since mass surveillance, thanks to the Edward Snowden disclosures, became at the fore of discussions about technological advances. Interesting to see how companies emerged recognizing that there was, in fact, a demand for this, some from a more niche marketplace, but now more broadly, even though it's not reached a point where we're seeing major tech firms unleash new products with privacy protections kind of baked in. So basically, people now have a greater understanding of what they might need to do in order to have a communication with a reporter that's more sensitive than, you know, might be considered, you know, typically prudent, but also what they would have to do to secure that from all but most, you know, the dedicated attacker, that being, you know, a state power.
Given sort of the line you hear from the White House with respect to fake news, and there are seem to be a lot of people who've tuned out mainstream news almost entirely, is that more concerning? Is this a more concerning time period relatively with respect to journalists being able to conduct, do their work without undue government influence?
So sort of two baskets of issues presented there. In terms of the kind of fake news bandwagon, I don't really see that being yet a hindrance to, you know, thoroughgoing, responsible, rigorous journalism, because you can, you know, you have ways of demonstrating to a reader that what you're doing is essentially telling a true story. Oftentimes document acquisition helps with this. And then, you know, on the flip side, the accusation is, you know, inseparable from a kind of will to power. And so a lot of people who are willing to toss out the fake news accusation more or less profligately aren't going to be convinced by anything that you do. Subjects of journalism like this know very well that it's very real journalism, I'll say that.
And on that note, have sources had a greater difficulty in coming forward? I remember that George W. Bush's administration was pretty rough on leakers. The Obama administration, if I understand it, was even more stringent. How have things been in the last 2 years or so?
Well, you're right in that description. As well, I've only been reporting on national security issues for the past, 15 years. So those are the only three administrations that I've been around to cover. Things just sort of generally seem to get worse in terms of a national political atmosphere towards investigative journalism. There was, particularly during the 2016 transition, going into 2017, and still into 2018, though I think it kind of trailed off a bit, extreme paranoia from those within the government, particularly non-political sources, about their exposure and talking to journalists. You will, of course, have noticed that there has been no shortage of investigative journalism throughout the Trump administration, that I think journalism on a national level has gotten less euphemistic and really more aggressive. So we can clearly see from the effects, without talking about any specific examples or specific cases or even specific agencies, that there's no shortage of people who want to aid in revealing to the public what their government is doing.
You recently wrote about the Senate's vote on the war in Yemen. And, you quote Bernie Sanders here saying that members of Congress passed the War Powers Act because they understood that the constitutional responsibility for war had slipped away from Congress and into the hands of the White House. And they said that's wrong, but it's taken us 45 years to finally act on the legislation in a positive way and to pass a resolution which ends U.S. participation in an unconstitutional war. That's Bernie Sanders talking to the Daily Beast. What do you view as what has essentially changed in this moment, given, people, reporters like Jamal Khashoggi being executed very likely at the direction of Saudi Arabia? Did his death really trigger this?
Khashoggi's murder was a signal event. I would view it more from everyone I talked to as a kind of, crack that ultimately burst the dam. That in itself conceals the accumulation of pressure that leads to the actual crack bursting the dam. The alarm is really palpable in the sense that Mohammed bin Salman, unlike anything we've seen from this impossibly, unfathomably wealthy and powerful family that controls this rather resource-intensive, wealthy, and regionally influential nation. This is someone who can stick around for 40, 50, years, possibly longer, in control of this country. And you've watched over the past several years of his rise, seeing the crown prince seize power and then seeing what he does with that power. It's easy to forget that before he was crown prince, he was defense minister of Saudi Arabia, and so is the architect of one of the world's most devastating conflicts. And the outrage in the Senate really was rather marginal, with the exception of, significant figures like, Bernie Sanders, Mike Lee, Chris Murphy, who really did ask about, the outbreak of cholera in Yemen, the devastating blockade of the port of Hodeidah, and et cetera. What happened with Khashoggi was that Mohammed bin Salman, who, saw as the lesson of him sidling up to the Trump administration, neutralizing the Obama administration, which was on its back foot towards Saudi Arabia because of Saudi's opposition to the Iran deal, that he could get away with all of this because the scene in Yemen was so grotesque as to be, practically invisible through how just astonishingly bloody and pitiless that it was. Whereas with Jamal Khashoggi, the egregiousness of this execution and the ways in which the lies that the Saudi royal family constructed around it fell apart so rapidly all conspire to form a watershed event. Something that we noticed as we were reporting ahead of the resolution passing procedurally on November 28th and then passing the full Senate on December 13th was that there were all number of administration-tied Republicans and some more hawkish Democrats who didn't want really to be put in the position of opposing the Pentagon's position that because refueling is a logistics activity, it doesn't rise to the threshold of being something the War Powers Act, the War Powers Resolution can speak to. The fact of the matter is they were sort of looking for an opportunity to jump off the ship of this resolution and were almost imploring the Trump administration to give them something to express their dissatisfaction with bin Salman and with Saudi Arabia over the Khashoggi murder, and the administration just didn't. So if there's, you know, in a sick way, something of a silver lining for Mohammed bin Salman in this, it's that, you know, from Foggy Bottom to the Pentagon to the White House, the Trump administration is not even remotely giving up on him. You've seen the Secretary of State wave the Iranian flag to say that, you know, whatever Mohammed bin Salman did or didn't do, you know, the issue is Iran. And if the U.S. pulls out of the Saudi-led coalition, then it's going to be, you know, Iran running rampant. And that just didn't work this time around. So it's, you know, it's not to be forgotten that this was a blunder, you know, on the White House's part as much as this was an aggravation on legislators' part with the principle of asserting control through the War Powers Act over, you know, a drift in war-making authority toward the executive. It's somewhat hard to disentangle all of these things.
As Congress turns over, some members of the Senate won't be there, notably Jeff Flake, who supported this resolution in the Senate. Nancy Pelosi will lead the House, and she has promised that this resolution that is nearly identical will pass the House sometime in 2019. Is there likely, do you expect then to be there be more pressure on the White House not to be so buddy-buddy with Saudi Arabia?
The pressure will definitely be there. This just hasn't happened in the history of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and it, as you point out, hasn't happened since the 1973 passage of the War Powers Resolution. The pressure is going to be there. I don't know how that, you know, shapes up, you know, in a more Republican Senate. Remember, since, you know, Congress is about to fully turn over, as you mentioned, this thing kind of goes back to square one in a formal legislative sense. Not so much in terms of extant public outrage and pressure. The kind of more lasting legacy of what the Senate did on Thursday the 13th might be that it demonstrated that there is no constituency in the U.S. legislature of any real size or scope for the Yemen war. That is already, I think, fair to say, putting pressure on negotiations that will seek to go next month in Stockholm from a ceasefire amongst combatants to a political process to wind down the war. But, you know, the administration has been pushed back over the last several months again and again here. You'll recall that the Pentagon, as a kind of fallback position, surely with the momentum for this resolution, thanks to the Khashoggi murder generating outrage in mind, stopped refueling operations for Saudi warplanes. Now, there's still the provision of weaponry and there's still intelligence being provided to the coalition. So by no means is the U.S. out of this conflict. Yet the administration, particularly in its operational elements, seems to recognize that they're, you know, not operating with time on their side. What we don't yet know is how Mohammed bin Salman responds to this. You know, you saw him at the G20, you know, getting lavishly dapped up by Vladimir Putin. The administration here in the United States wants to do as much as it can to avoid, you know, putting pressure on him, while, you know, going along with the line that, you know, this was done at a lower level, and they'll place sanctions on people who they have reason to believe were involved here. So it's really a circumstance in which the administration sort of will try and get away with as much as it can on supporting its favorite, you know, Saudi royal. And the more that happens, as we've seen over the last several weeks, the more opposition that stirs, the more opposition that provokes, and the more power that opposition accumulates by virtue of the fact of how egregious this murder was. From a journalistic perspective, from the perspective of a journalist, you know, one thing that seems worth mentioning is that it's yet another reminder that while, you know, Khashoggi's murder happened in another country at the behest of a third government, and Turkey, by, you know, by no stretch of the imagination, is a positive case, particularly for press freedom, it absolutely is not. It's, I think, brought home to a lot of journalists in the United States that a greater degree of solidarity, perhaps, with our international colleagues is really warranted, and that press freedoms internationally and press freedoms domestically have to be treated as one and the same thing in an era of rising authoritarianism.
Spencer Ackerman is a reporter at The Daily Beast. We spoke during the Cato Institute's SpyCon last week. 2018 is almost over, and I'd like to ask you to consider supporting the Cato podcast and the broad mission of the Cato Institute by joining our podcast sponsor program. Visit cato.org/podcast sponsor and learn more of the benefits of sponsorship. That's cato.org/podcast sponsor.